You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Across the country over the past several weeks, people attempting to express anti-war sentiments have all too often found themselves punished for showcasing their beliefs. A man in Albany, New York, was arrested in a mall last month for wearing a T-shirt that read, "Give Peace a Chance." A girl on the basketball team at St. Mary's College in Newburgh, New York, was booed off the court for refusing to sing the Star-Spangled Banner. And a high school student in Michigan was suspended for wearing a shirt calling Bush a, quote, "international terrorist," unquote. Peace Watch got a call this morning from Alan Cooper, who teaches English to foreign students at Highland High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mr. Cooper says that now it's not just the students who are getting suspended for expressing their beliefs. He joins us now on the line. Welcome to Peace Watch, Alan Cooper.
Thank you.
So, Alan, why were you and your fellow teacher, Jeff Barrett, suspended?
We were suspended for allowing students to place their opinions on the wall.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in Jeff's case, there were a series of posters that students did as part of their subject matter, expressing their opinions. Some were pro-war, some were support the troops, some were, you know, out of Iraq now. But they were all put placed there by students. In my case, I think it's kind of an unusual case. I have seven language groups in my classroom. And one of my Afghani students made a crude, it was not really, you know, high artistic value. It was the back of an M&M box, and he put, "No war, Mr. Cooper," and put it up on the board. And this student lost some of his relatives in Afghanistan during the bombing, American bombing of Afghanistan. And I felt like I needed to honor that feeling that he had, or that opinion that he had, in putting it on the wall in my classroom.
And were there posters supporting the war as well?
No, but we've had, and if somebody had done that, they would be up. Nobody has done that. Although I have students who are pro-war and anti-war and in between. And the students, I think this is something that would really be important for people to hear, and that is that students everywhere are very upset about the war. Their anxieties levels up. They're acting out. Students have dads and sons and brothers. I have family that's in Afghanistan right now that may be killed, and you know, so there's a lot of anxiety, and I think a lot of school districts are not doing anything about it. They're just trying to clamp down, and I think what they need to do is exactly the opposite, which is to open up and give the students a voice. Let them, you know. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So you're an English teacher, not a history teacher.
I'm an ESL teacher. English is a second language.
Okay. So I would imagine that many of your students probably come from places around the world.
Yeah, I have students from Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, Mexico, Argentina, mm-hmm. You know, all over.
One might ask,
Vietnamese,
why is
Chinese.
An English teacher dealing with this subject matter that might be more appropriately in a history class or a geography class or
a
world studies class?
I think it's appropriate in any class, because if it's an issue, and my purpose is to get them to learn how to speak better English, whatever is at hand, you know, whatever is on their minds, and it's a way for them to kind of have a little therapy session to get things out, and they're talking English, which is my goal.
So what exactly was the justification that the vice principal gave you and Mr. Barrett for your suspension? Insubordination.
Yeah. They told me to take the sign down, and they told Jeff to take his student signs down, and we decided not to.
Okay. And so are you going to take the signs down, or will...
They took them down.
The students themselves took them down?
No, the administration.
The administration.
Mm-hmm. It's real interesting that none of the signs that were up were in any way, you know, maligned or changed or graffitied or anything like that. I thought that was real interesting.
You told us this morning when we spoke with you that you contacted the ACLU about your case. What did they say when you asked them to represent you?
Oh, they asked me a couple of questions about the issue, and when I explained that we had refused to take the signs down that were made by students, they said that they could not take the case.
Mm-hmm. And so they just refused on the basis of what?
That we disobeyed district policy.
What's the general sentiment like in Albuquerque regarding this war, Alan Cooper?
Oh, I think there's a lot of opposition to the war, as there always is in poor and working class communities. I know that when we've leafleted in the valley down in a major intersection called Broadway and Cesar Chavez, about 9 out of 10 people take leaflets when we leaflet there. We have a sign that one of our signs is a way of drivers to participate, says honk for peace, and people just, it's a cacophony of noise. You can't even talk because there's so many people who are expressing themselves with their horns. Mm-hmm. I think there's a huge opposition to the war in the country, and I think it's being measured by in very narrow terms. If you go, you know, when you go into more wealthy parts of the town or near the base, mm-hmm. the odds go down, of course.
Alan Cooper, who teaches English to foreign students at Highland High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Thank you for your work, Verna.
Thank you very much, Alan Cooper. When you peel away the duct tape and plastic sheets of Homeland Security to look at the real threat posed by weapons of mass destruction, there's often another story. It's not one of the sinister bin Laden or Saddam Hussein developing new biological weapons, but one of billions spent at U.S. bioweapons labs dreaming up new pathogens to defend against and for money diverted from community health centers. Independent reporter Eddie Becker examines the last anthrax attack and stumbles on the real threats to our security.
The United States has already been attacked with anthrax just after September 11th, and most people around at that time probably associated that attack with bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Anthrax was later indelibly associated to Iraq after Secretary of State Colin Powell, in his losing effort to get the United Nations to back the invasion of Iraq, held up a vial of white powder saying, just that tiny amount, if it were a weapons-grade anthrax, could kill millions of people. So I'm at this conference on Homeland Security, crawling with scientists, anti-terrorist experts, and bureaucrats, and over cheese wedges I meet Tony Morrison, director of the Institute of Epidemiology and Health Services Research at Jackson State University in Mississippi. Tony had a jump start on most Johnny-come-latelys. He's been studying biological terrorism even before September 11th.
We applied for a grant from FEMA, and we got a contract, for $40,000, to develop a course called Bioterrorism Preparedness and Response. And we developed this, and we were talking about anthrax and crop dusters in August of 2001, just before the events of 9/11.
There was a biological attack right after 9/11.
That's right, the anthrax spores.
That was a very high grade of anthrax.
So I understand.
Now, you must have studied that extensively, followed all the newspapers.
I did. Well, my theory is that it's clearly an act perpetrated by a disgruntled person in this country. I must say I was rather impressed by the evidence linking the person that was suspected with the letters.
Now, this is the person they're now calling the person of interest.
It's a very strange business.
The Justice Department has said there are 20 persons of interest in the anthrax investigation, but has named only one publicly, Stephen J. Hatfield, a scientist at the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. The FBI searched Mr. Hatfield's apartment several times and recently employed divers on two occasions to search a pond near Fort Detrick after a tip that lab equipment used in the anthrax attack were dumped there. After Fort Detrick, Hatfield went to work for a Virginia Defense Intelligence contractor called Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC. At SAIC, Hatfield commissioned a classified report that included an anthrax by mail scenario. Hatfield reportedly failed a polygraph exam and lost his security clearance in August 2001, which some speculate could have made him angry. Anyway, Mr. Hatfield has maintained his innocence and has called press conferences to decry the government for ruining his life. So I was delighted to have run into the former commander of Fort Detrick, Major General John S. Parker, now working for SAIC to support their National Homeland Defense initiatives in the areas of chemical and biological defense, public health, and biosurveillance. Parker was the commander of Fort Detrick from 1997 until his retirement in 2002. His command spanned the period when the highly refined weapons-grade anthrax spores, which experts believe could have only come from his U.S. military lab, likely disappeared. So I asked him how he would feel if it did turn out that the anthrax had come from his lab.
Well, at being the commander at Fort Detrick, I obviously would feel upset if it had come from Fort Detrick. But in the same words, this is a pathogen that could be used against the United States of America, and for a long time, the laboratory at Fort Detrick was the only laboratory looking for proper protection against this. If it hadn't been for the work that was done at Fort Detrick, we wouldn't know that ciprofloxacin was good against this this pathogen. So I would say that I don't know where it came from.
I had the impression that the general had been questioned a lot over the last year or so. What amazes me about many people I meet is how well they seem to recover from extraordinarily bad situations by being able to consistently look on the brighter side of things. And maybe Fort Detrick, under his leadership, was able to figure out that people infected with a highly refined weapons-grade anthrax could be saved with a dose of Cipro antibiotic. But in order to do that, they had to develop this highly refined and weaponized anthrax spore first. A spore, at least from what I've read, no one else had, which was pretty much why it was traced back to their lab in the first place. Anyway, biodefense has become a major industry, and General Parker and his crew will get a pocket full of money to dream up some new hypothetical threat that they need to cure.
Most of us are here at this conference because of the lure of, what, $44 billion that may be dispersed to, prepare us for bioterrorist attack.
Back to Tony Morrison, director of the Institute of Epidemiology and Health Services Research at Jackson State University in Mississippi.
You see, there are a lot of real problems which are not being addressed. And it's the real problems are the ones that are not getting the money and could suffer greatly from this emphasis on a hypothetical problem, bioterrorism. One of the dangers is the bioterrorism, shall we say, overemphasis, is that the problems that we have in this country in terms of diseases that affect minorities could be relatively neglected. Certainly one of the things we're interested in is in the extraordinary high rates of renal failure among young African-American males. It's something like 20 times higher than among white males. And we're wondering if, in fact, exposure to lead, because of the fact that poor people live close to waste dumps and the quality of the housing is poor, etc., and they may get more exposure to heavy metal poisoning than the average person. So this is an extraordinarily prevalent problem among African-Americans in particular. So to me, public health has got sidetracked.
Tony's institute will be getting $350,000 from Homeland Defense to monitor the Mississippi Delta against a hypothetical chemical or biological attack. But it remains to be seen whether he'll be allowed to turn his sensors towards the industrial smokestacks and incinerator chimneys now killing the people he's supposed to protect. One would think that Major General John S. Parker, former commander of the Biological Weapons Center at Fort Detrick until 2002 and now leading the SAIC's Biomedical Homeland Defense Initiative, would know something about Iraqis' biological weapons capabilities.
Do you think there's any credible evidence that Iraq has biological weapons?
Well, the way I stand on that is that the President of the United States has our national security as one of his responsibilities. If the President, through his intelligence networks and everything else, believes that there's something in Iraq that is a threat to our national security, I back the President of the United States. And that's called faith in leadership, and I believe in faith in leadership.
What about science? Is there any science behind his faith? I mean, that's what they always say about God, but I'm just talking about something you might be more of an expert in.
I can't answer that question because I don't have the knowledge.
I thank General Parker for his honesty. His 37-year military career has given him faith in the command structure, the president, and probably in God, all of which has gotten him through some pretty rough times. And as I write this, bombs and bullets rain down on Iraq, and most of the world seems ready to rise up and condemn the United States. And I can only think that blind faith, rather than knowledge and wisdom, contributed in part to getting us there. This is Eddie Becker reporting for Peace Watch.
Guiltiness from Bob Marley's Exodus CD. Most journalists left Palestine to cover the war against Iraq as Israel escalated its aggression against the Palestinian people. That's according to Diana Boutu, legal advisor to the Palestine Liberation Organization. Boutu spoke recently with Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch producer at WPFW in Washington.
The United States and UK forces are attacking Iraq. And in Palestine, where you just came from, what's going on?
The ethnic cleansing process that Israel has now carried out for 55 years is continuing. For the past 2.5 years, we've seen well over 2,000 Palestinians killed directly from Israeli fire, not to mention those killed because they haven't been able to get medical assistance. We've seen thousands of homes demolished. It's now up to about well over 1% of the population killed or injured directly by Israel's fire. This has now continued and intensified since the war has started. There have been over 20 Palestinians killed in the course of the week alone. More homes have been demolished over the course of the past week. And Israel's now going to begin construction of this so-called security wall that was at one point only going to be along the western part of the West Bank. But now Israel has made it very clear that they intend to isolate the Palestinians into the equivalent of Native American Indian reservations by putting the wall all around Palestinian cities, towns, and villages.
But Israel says that it doesn't want to be part of this war on Iraq.
It's the exact opposite. It's a war that the United States and Britain are fighting in the name of Israel. We all know very clearly that this is yet another act of colonization, and that this is simply a means of placating Israel. It's a means of putting into place a new regime that will be more favorable to Israel than other regimes in the Middle East have been in the past. There are U.S. troops stationed in Israel to launch military airstrikes against Iraq. So Israel is just as much involved as Britain and the United States are.
Is U.S. stationing in Israel legal?
It is legal in that Israel has granted the United States access there. But it's at the same time carrying out an illegal war. This isn't a war that has been sanctioned by the United Nations. Even if it was, I would go so far as to say that it wasn't legal. But at the same time, even though you can use the guise of legality, it doesn't mean that their presence there is legal.
Why do you say this war is illegal?
The guise that they launched this war under was the fact that, according to the United States, Iraq hasn't complied with 16 UN resolutions. Let's take a look at history and the records of history. Israel hasn't complied with 85 UN Security Council resolutions. It has not complied with these resolutions, not for 12 years, as they allege Iraq hasn't complied, but for, in some cases, 55 years, and with respect to the territories, for 35 years. And yet we don't see the same sort of action being taken against Israel as we do with respect to Iraq. There has never been UN sanctions on Israel. Israel has never been kicked out of the UN, even though one of its conditions for entry into the UN was that it allow the refugees to return to their homes. It has simply been flying in the face of international law now for 55 years. So you can't, on the one hand, say that you're trying to uphold international law with respect to Iraq and then not uphold international law with respect to Israel, a country that has violated 85 UN Security Council resolutions.
United States was talking about putting some of the Iraqis in front of international tribunals because of what they have done during the war. Yet this country has not ratified or even signed on to the international tribunal agreement.
The United States is now placing extreme emphasis on the application of the Fourth Geneva Convention. For 35 years, the Palestinians have been screaming about the application of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And the Fourth Geneva Convention doesn't only talk about wartime situations. It talks about occupation and what a country is supposed to do when it is occupying another. And for the past 35 years, Israel has violated all those rules of occupation. We've repeatedly said it to the United States, and the United States has completely ignored any plea made by the Palestinians about the Fourth Geneva Convention. It's suddenly now that when American soldiers are involved that the Fourth Geneva Convention becomes applicable and that international law becomes applicable, when for the past 55 years we know that Israel and the United States have flown in the face of international law.
And recently the United States has bombed the station of Iraqi transmission. Mm-hmm. Is this an infringement of the Geneva Convention?
Yes, absolutely, because not only is it hindering freedom of speech, but the very location of where that place was situated was in a civilian area. It's military targets that are supposed to be hit. And a television station trying to broadcast any television show is certainly not a military target.
How about rushing into the hospital in Iraq? The United States claims that it did find soldiers there.
They're following the exact same arguments that Israel has used with respect to the Palestinians, of trying to portray civilians who are resisting a foreign invading army as somehow being military or what they would call paramilitary. I think that the United States and Israel need to get the message very clear. You are a foreign invading army, and don't be surprised if people are resisting your presence in their very nations.
Does the Geneva Convention protect also civilians that are resisting an invading army?
It protects civilians who aren't acting out in force of war. So, yes, if a foreign invading army is coming in, they are under protection. There are certain rights that have to be upheld.
With all the Fidayeen, the special forces of the Iraqis, I would say the equivalent of the SEALs, commandos for United States military machine, the United States are calling them terrorists. What does legally this usage of a word imply?
Yeah, the word terrorism is one that's been used all too liberally in this country. And my understanding of the word terrorism is attacking of civilians randomly selected civilians for political purpose. And yet, somehow, when a soldier is killed, it's suddenly called terrorism. They're not civilians. Somehow, when settlers are killed, it's also considered that that's terrorism. They're not civilians. They are not randomly selected civilians.
A lot of people think the settlers are civilians.
But they are not. These are the very people who are going in, who are colonizing Palestinian territory. These are people who don't get the protections of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Only those people who are under occupation get the protection of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And it's also important to remember that these people are, if they are killed, they're not being killed because they're civilians. They're being killed because they are settlers, because they are colonizers, and they're not randomly selected individuals.
So what would be your legal commentary on the treatment of the prisoners from Afghanistan and other countries that are now in Guantanamo Bay?
Well, again, this is yet another attempt by the United States to avoid the application of the Fourth Geneva Convention or have selective application of the Geneva Conventions. When it came to the prisoners of war in Guantanamo Bay, the United States said that they would be treated humanely, but that the Fourth Geneva Convention didn't apply. And now that the tides are turned, now that the roles are reversed, the United States is screaming and yelling that its soldiers have to be treated according to the provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention. It's a selective application of international law, saying that they're only subject to international law when it works in their favor, but not subject to international law when it doesn't work in their favor.
Diana Bhutu, a legal advisor to the Palestine Liberation Organization. She was speaking with Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch producer at WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington. Finally, on a lighter note, we have this piece from the radio satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players.
We interrupt your relevant scheduled programming for this commercial media report from the Rumala oil fields in Iraq.
It's light and sweet, and it wants to leap out of the ground. One barrel costs only $5 to produce, a third or less of what it costs many other countries. Right now, oil sells for around $30 a barrel. Whenever the day comes, Iraq will be able to sell it for $20 or less and still make a tidy profit. $20 a barrel oil could knock 20% off the cost of gasoline. Whether you're for the war or against it, whether the fighting goes smoothly or not, one day, the oil fields of Iraq are going to make a difference in how much you pay to fill up your car. Richard Blystone, CNN, Rumala Oil Field, Southern Iraq.
Thank you, CNN. That was interesting.
The Christmas Coup Comedy Players from Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA and Keith Chalgion. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. Listeners may want to tune in to the NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw tomorrow, Wednesday evening, to see a special story on Peace Watch, Pacifica Radio, and Voices of Dissent in this time of war. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.